Welcome, everyone, to Redacted on this Community Wednesday. We love all your feedback on these days where you get your comments into our guests, and we try to do as much of that audience interaction on this Wednesday as we can, because we are going to be diving into the question, are we already in World War III? So many of you in the comments will say, guys, we're already in World War III. Well, the New York Times yesterday posting an opinion piece asking that very question, are we here? And maybe it's a different type of warfare, a massive sanction, economic warfare, cyber attacks. Maybe it does not look like the traditional hot war.
Oh, but it's definitely not good for us, like most wars. It's not for the plebeians that are here watching this show. Thank you so much for joining us. We're also going to talk about how Israel is funneling money through Ted Cruz's podcast. Kind of offensive that anyone would listen to a Ted Cruz podcast. Do you think we have even one overlapping viewer between Ted Cruz and Redacted?
Yeah, can we ask anyone in the audience right now, to the thousands of you watching out there, have any of you ever sat down to listen to a Ted Cruz podcast?
Are you subscribed? Well, our portals will tell us if we have overlapping views, but I would be shocked and amazed. If so, what do you get there? Anyhow,
I feel like if I was listening to a Ted Cruz Ted Cruz podcast, it's because I've been captured and somebody's committing a war crime against me. That's just kind of my
right.
It's Clockwork Orange, where you're being sat there with your eyes forced open to watch the thing. That would be torture in and of itself.
Exactly right.
Joe Kent is going to join us here in moments to talk about all of that. Plus, we're going to talk about right now economic D-Day. You heard Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent the other day, of course, basically articulating this massive new economic sanction plan, Operation Outcast against Iran. Will it work? Will it hurt the United States more? We're going to talk about that with Professor Robert Pape a little bit later in the show. But first,
we want to tell you how you can communicate with us through Rumble Wallet. This is a paid advertisement for Rumble Wallet. They are sponsoring this ad. And if you want to directly talk to us, you can use rants using Rumble Wallet. Rumble Wallet rants get top priority. So get your questions and hot takes on, and then they don't disappear quickly and they're less fast moving in the chat. Rumble Wallet also puts more of your support where you want it with creators like us. It's easy to get started, and MoonPay lets you purchase crypto just like any other online purchase. For a limited time, go to wallet.rumble.com, enter our exclusive promo code REDACTED10 to claim $10 in U.S. stablecoin for tipping Rumble creators. You can also scan the QR code that you see there or visit our link in the description. And again, the promo code is REDACTED10. So then you open the chat, create a rant, and select Pay with Rumble Wallet, and we'll be looking out for them. No purchase necessary, U.S. residents only, void in New York and where prohibited, and you must be 18 or older. It's limited to the first 500 eligible wallet activated and funded, so restrictions apply. Visit rumble.com/promo official rules for complete rules. So again, that's wallet.rumble.com/redacted. I did that without my glasses. Look
wow,
at this.
Wow, way to go.
My eyes are improving, so I showed up without glasses because I've been doing my red light therapy.
Mine are getting better, too, actually. I didn't wear them all morning. But anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. My eyes, no one cares about that, but my sty is better.
So maybe thank you for that update.
Yeah, there's that sty update.
Oh, you can give a health update, sty but update. Natalie, nobody cares about yours.
So many people have been waiting with bated breath on the sty. Sty Watch 2026.
Made so much money on Khaleesi on that eye, sty, so I'm telling you what.
Exactly. Is there anything on whether Natalie will wear reading glasses?
Let's check it out. Well, we are witnessing one of the most consequential geopolitical shifts since the Cold War. Countries running, of course, away from the U.S. dollar into the hands of the BRICS nations over the past several months. The conflict with Iran has evolved from airstrikes and proxy battles into an economic battlefield right now. So is that the future of this war? Iran is leveraging the Strait of Hormuz. We're getting conflicting messages from the Trump administration today on mines in the Strait of Hormuz. They're open. Hey, ships are free to go through there. By the way, who's going to be the first ship that like raises its hands like, yeah, let me test that theory. All the mines are removed. Let's go and see. Let's see if we blow up on the way through there. The Trump administration appears to be pivoting, of course, away from military strikes, if you listen to reports from Secretary of State Marco Rubio, to sanctions and economic pressure for now. And then meanwhile, last night, the New York Times published this piece asking this question, and far be it for me to ever feature a New York Times piece on the show, but it does raise an interesting question. Has World War III already started. And for many of you watching the show, very often in the comments, you'll say, guys, World War III has already started. Like, that ship has already sailed. But what does it exactly look like? Where is all of this heading? Joining us now is Joe Kent, former director of the National Counterterrorism Center and retired U.S. Army Green Beret. And Joe, of course, has been at the center of the debate over America's Iran policy and the future of U.S. involvement in the Middle East, being really a clear-headed voice in all of this. Joe, welcome back to the show. Great to see you.
Great to be with you both. Thank you for having me.
Well, first on this New York Times question, I mean, I know it's like a 30,000-foot level question, but what do you make of this question? Are we already in World War III? And if so, maybe how is it different than the world wars that we're accustomed to watching on the History Channel?
I mean, I think it's pretty evident to you both and probably most of your viewers, because you're paying attention to this, that World War III has definitely began. It's in the early phases. I believe that we can still kind of rein this back with the proper leadership. I think there is still time to walk this back before things are just, you know, so far off the rails that we experienced a catastrophic war. But I am kind of glad to see the New York Times at least asking the question. I mean, when we have a regional war like the war with Iran that is involving, you know, most of the regional powers in the Middle East, it's involving us. And then you have the Russia-Ukraine conflict where we have been supporting the Ukrainians, NATO has been supporting the Ukrainians, and that war is continuing to escalate. And now we're seeing a blending of the two fronts. For quite some time, the Iranians have been supporting the Russians with drones and with some other military assistance. And then recently we saw the Ukrainians take a strike in the Caspian Sea against an Iranian vessel. And so I fear that these two fronts could become blended. And as one escalates, the other one escalates as well. I fear that if we see some kind of escalation because of President Trump's frustration with the status of the Straits of Hormuz and our inability to get a clear victory with Iran, that Israel escalates and uses some form of a nuclear weapon, which would essentially then greenlight Putin using a nuclear weapon in Ukraine, which would then be right on the doorstep of Europe. And then after that, you know, kind of all bets are off. So I think we're in a very dicey situation right now. We just had the CIA director fly over to Moscow. Who knows what they, you know, precisely discussed, but I think it's pretty obvious we are trying to get the Russians not to escalate anything any further. However, I don't know why the Russians would take us seriously, because we've made no effort whatsoever to restrain the Ukrainians. The Russians know that we're kind of spread thin right now. So, I mean, I think we're teetering on the verge of this thing getting to the point where it can't be put back in the box. So I think we've got a limited amount of opportunity right now to stop this war from spiraling even further.
Wow.
And yet the war continues to have a low record of support. And so we continuously see these stories from mainstream media. Last week it was Iran hacked a British power plant. This week it's China hacked the Federal Reserve. We don't have any proof of that. It's just escalating rhetoric that these are our enemies. And so I don't know why they're still doing this, because it doesn't work. What do you make of these continuously unsourced stories of fear-mongering?
Well, I think because the American people are weary of wars, which is ironically a big reason why President Trump won the election. You know, both in right. all the times that President Trump has won the presidency, he has run heavily on, you know, repudiating American foreign policy, in particular in the Middle East. So the American people are sick of these wars. That's obvious. All the polling says that. However, the Uniparty in Washington, D.C., they want this war. This is why you're not seeing any Democrats really come out in a meaningful way right now and attack President Trump. They're using it as some red meat here and there, and they'll say some stuff in some hearings every now and again to, you know, the Secretary of War, the Secretary of State, but there's no real Democrat opposition to this war. This is Washington, D.C.'s consensus. They want this war. Now, they know that if this war continues to expand, the American people are going to be hurt more economically than they already have been. The price of the pump, cost of living, inflation, etc. But if this war does accelerate and the two wars combine, which if you listen to the neocons in Washington, D.C., backed by the Israel lobby and all the Atlanticists and, you know, big supporters of NATO and the war in Ukraine, they want these wars to merge and they want to get the American people on board. So I think they are trying to sell, hey, there's a combination of like the Russians, who we all know are secret commies, and they're combining with the Islamist, you know, Iranians, and this is an existential threat. And look at all these different things that are happening, and we're on the precipice, and so we need to take action now. I mean, it's just the same old, you know, propaganda that we've heard in the lead up to every single war. I'm not saying that all the stories are false. For us to think that we're going to be conducting all the military actions that we're conducting throughout the world, and some of it's not going to come back here and hit us in some way, shape, or form, that would be extremely naive. But I think there is a narrative that is being crafted right now with people on the left, people on the right, and just the mainstream media in general that is trying to get the American people ready for some kind of a new war. They've already been vilifying the Russians and vilifying Putin now for quite some time. And then we have all of the tired, you know, George W. Bush talking points about the terrorists. And we've been calling the Iranians terrorists now since this war began. That combined with, you know, we have to stop them from having a nuclear weapon. It's really just a rollout all over again of the 2003 talking points. But like you said, I mean, these propaganda techniques, they work, or at least they work enough to give some semblance of a political consensus. But I think the administration knows that it's not going to work, which is why the administration took no effort whatsoever to sell the Iran war. They just woke up on February 28, and next thing you know, we're in this war, and they didn't make any effort whatsoever to sell it to us.
Yeah, and I mean, if I could just give you a little opportunity to gloat, because you resigned just a few weeks later. And, you know, you were called a panickin. You didn't have any faith. This is going to be over soon. And look at us now. We're almost in September. So
6 months
later. That played out pretty well for you. I'm going to say history was on your side. It's not a question. I just wanted to say that. Go ahead, Clayton.
Well, I
don't like being right, though. I wish I would have been wrong. I wish President Trump would have been like, you know, Kent and Tucker and Redacted, they're a bunch of panickins, and he would have said the whole thing was great and I won, you know, the day after I resigned or whatever. But here we are. So unfortunately,
there was an article, I mean, totally somewhat related, but the other day about how Trump is now losing the manosphere. I just like that headline popped up, like men like yourself, like myself, people who maybe were supportive of President Trump, or at least the idea of no new wars in the Middle East, and we're going to focus on the United States of America. These men who, like, all of them feel duped. Like, the underlying message was they all feel duped. And call them panickins, call them whatever you want. But now these men are, like, just turning against the president in a big, big way. I think a lot of people feel duped. Again, not really a question, but just kind of a statement of something I saw. I want to ask you about the propaganda piece, because I think you were – one of the things you're kind of pointing out there is this idea of a false flag. Like, we don't support this. And this idea of, well, we're going to need like another 9/11 style event. You know, Mike Pompeo is all over Fox News over the past few days. Once again, like, you know, you're seeing the BBC, you're seeing the UK silence independent media voices and trying to elevate like the BBC and state-run media. You're seeing the same thing in Canada. It's only a matter of time, I think, before the same thing happens here in the United States, more suppression of independent voices. So you can rally the sort of fake support around this idea of a war against Russia and Iran. I mean, I don't want to say that, you know, that this is going to happen. I want to sort of warn people that these things seem to be coming. Is that kind of what you're alluding to, that there needs to be some sort of rallying false flag and they're hoping to kind of rally us together against this?
I think that's a possibility. And I think the one rule of thumb that we should all stick to at this point is just question everything. Because like Charlie Kirk said, question everything, because it's the only thing that keeps us free. We have no obligation whatsoever at this point to trust our government. I think a big reason, you know, I think this is combined with the whole, you know, question of why men are, you know, starting to say, hey, I feel betrayed by the Trump administration. One of Trump's big appeals was that he was the guy who questioned everything. And so a lot of what, you know, I think this generation of young male voters who helped President Trump come into power, and young people in general, was that, hey, we do question everything. And so I think these two things are very related. President Trump is losing a lot of support with, you know, his core base and a lot of really young men who came up questioning COVID, you know, questioning the BLM riots, questioning January 6th, questioning, you know, mail-in ballots in the election. But now we're just told that, like, you know, Iran was 5 minutes away from getting a nuclear weapon and we need to be all in with this war. We should be very, very wary of any potential false flags. But what I think is more dangerous is that we are playing with fire right now on two very, very hostile fronts. We basically refuse to leave this Iran war. President Trump knows he can't, you know, extract a military victory out of Iran. He knows the diplomacy track is basically dead, because when we had an opportunity to off-ramp with the MOU, within less than a week, we basically blew up the MOU. And President Trump is not leaving, he's not withdrawing our forces from the region. He's leaving them over there within striking distance of the Iranians, both the Iranians and and the Houthis have proven they can hit our boats that are out there in the ocean. The Houthis just conducted a strike that was, you know, several hundred kilometers, you know, away from where they launched the missile. So they are on a boat. So they actually have the ability to conduct these types of strikes. And so I think for us to say that we're going to throw economic D-Day at Iran and we're basically going to starve their people and make them endure all kind of economic hardship while we leave our troops within range, it's basically asking for the Iranians just to strike us to give us a justification to go right back into the war. If that wasn't the case, then what President Trump would do is he would pull out our troops and he'd pull our naval blockade away so the Iranians couldn't actually hit it. And then he would say, okay, now I'm going to sanction you guys. And there's nothing really that you could do about it. If you want relief from the sanctions, then now we can talk shop and you can open the Straits of Hormuz. But he's not doing that. He's leaving our forces there where they can still be hit. So we're poking the Iranians and saying, like, you know, just take it on the chin. And the Iranians are even coming out and saying, we're not just going to take this. We're going to strike back. So we're setting ourselves up to be dragged right back into this. And to me, because we should know what's going to happen, it seems very, very deliberate. And to a lesser extent, the same thing is taking place with on the Russia-Ukraine front. I mean, for a very long time now, we've been obviously funding and supplying Ukraine with intelligence and weaponry, and that they are now striking Russian civilian infrastructure and they're striking energy. But then we're going to go to the Russians and say, like, hey, you guys can't hit back. So we are basically doing everything to stoke the fire, and it could kick off in a way that we haven't predicted. And the next thing you know, we are in this, and then we are going to need the American people to rally behind, because we're going to pretend like, you know, the audacious and evil enemy has struck us in a way that was just, you know, not predictable, because we are fighting like gentlemen and they're now fighting like, you know, dirty terrorists or, you know, crazy Russians or crazy communists or whatever. So yeah, I think these are incredibly dangerous times, and the amount of propaganda that's being applied onto the American people right now makes that very evident.
I mean, it's, yeah, we're going to need like a Red Dawn moment from the 1980s. Like, this is the enemy. We're being invaded by Russia to rally us around. I'm glad you brought up Russia, Ukraine, because what with this economic D-Day against Iran, I mean, Russia's not just going to sit back. I don't think China's going to sit back either. What do you think will be the response from Russia, China, if this is really strangling Iran to the point of, you know, nearing death, I guess, is what the administration would love to see happen.
You know, it's interesting because we've just overplayed sanctions so much over the last several decades that by the time we go and say that, like, we're going to throw economic D-Day at a country, I mean, Iran's been under sanctions now since the Islamic Republic's inception. So for 47 years, these guys have been under sanctions. So I'm not sure how scared they get when any American official comes out and is like, we're going to sanction you. It's the secondary sanctions that could sting. But, you know, like I mean, Scott Bissett himself said during the press conference when he was asked, like, why aren't you applying the secondary sanctions now? And he said, like, what makes you think I'd want to tank the entire world economy? Something to that effect. So if we're really going to go through with the secondary sanctions, we're going to hurt ourselves like way more than we're going to hurt the Iranians. That's why I kind of think I'm glad that we're not escalating anymore militarily. I mean, 2 weeks ago, you know, President Trump was talking about going back to the battlefield in a very big way and using all that really bombastic rhetoric. So I'm glad we've backed off from that. But again, this is where I'm just like, I don't know how serious these sanctions are. Now, Russia and China and basically most other countries in the world, because of the Russia-Ukraine war, they have started coming up with alternative workarounds from the dollar. And again, this is a place where we threw the kitchen sink of sanctions at Russia right after Russia invaded Ukraine. We threw them off SWIFT, and that was supposed to be like some, you know, death blow to the Russians, but they endured. And right, it made, exactly, it's laughable. Yeah. That made China stronger. This war with Iran made China stronger. I mean, we actually had to pull our naval assets out of the Pacific, which is absolute insanity, considering the Pacific actually is our border and not the Middle East, to go reinforce what's taking place here. The petrodollar is being eroded. So we just continue to shoot ourselves in the foot, and China's going to sit back and laugh. So I think if we actually go through with any of the secondary sanctions, I think China's just going to sit back and they're going to go to the rest of the world and say, hey, we are the stability, we're the stable power. You want to do business with us, move away from doing business with the Iranians, if it even gets that far. I think the Iranians right now are going to have to either strike us back or put a lot of effort into keeping the Straits of Hormuz restricted to hurt us economically, which in turn is probably going to make us strike them back when Trump gets frustrated that the economic D-Day isn't working.
But this is what I think should break your loyalty to partisan politics, if you're paying attention at all. This idea that we have a new idea, sanctions on Iran. Okay, Obama did this to great effect for the whole of his presidency. And in fact, he tried to ramp up sanctions time and time again. So if you're not paying attention, they do the same shit. This is not new. This is not new information. So how they could launch this as if, like, this is it. This is what's going to, you know, you have to laugh because you know better. Otherwise, you're their pawns. I just can't understand how they could do this with a straight face. We've been there. We did this. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, Bessent really didn't do it with a straight face. I mean, if you watched his press conference, he was like out of breath. It was almost like as if he didn't believe it. You had his old like co-host or cohort, Stanley Druckenmiller, writing a piece in the Wall Street Journal, basically saying, you know, the U.S. dollar is collapsing. You better stop this debt spiral that you're causing in the United States. So you have like his old friend publishing this Wall Street Journal piece kind of, and he's out there. It almost sounded like he didn't believe it. I mean, he was just kind of carrying in the water for the administration. That's kind of what it sounded like to me, Joe.
Yeah, I mean, he's a very knowledgeable person on finance and markets. I mean, look at his background. So he's no lightweight. So I think that probably explains his demeanor during that press conference. I think it's hard when you're deeply knowledgeable on a subject to get out there and sell something that you just know isn't going to work. I mean, just like the economic D-Day. I mean, you know, in theory, like if you're going to sanction somebody, in order for them to do what you want, you have to have – there has to be some way for you to walk that back. And otherwise, they're not going to change their behavior. It's hard for us to go from we're going to kill all your leadership, including your supreme leader, to now we're going to sanction you. I mean, what are they going to say? Like, okay, or you're going to do what? Kill our leaders? Like we're kind of back to square one. So I think unless you have a lot of skill at acting, it's hard to sell a lot of these policies that just fundamentally are not serious and just kind of meant to manipulate the markets and the American people.
Yeah. I just want to ask you before we let you go about the idea, you know, of counterterrorism. Of course, that was your previous job. And there have been some things that haven't really been reported over the past couple of weeks in the United States. They've kind of been buried, but major air traffic control outages, you know, in major airports, I think through Minnesota and other places that haven't gotten any reporting, where they had to divert traffic over the United States. And we're not just talking like one tower went down, like multiple independent towers down, fiber lines separated from each other down. And so I guess, and I think about the grid in the United States, and I think about our sort of fragile cyber network, and then Natalie's question earlier about the idea of the Fed being hacked by China. Like, is this the kind of new warfare that we're going to have to get used to in the United States? And how can we trust like where it's coming from? Is it coming from our own deep state, or is it legitimately coming from China or Russia or some other place?
Well, with a lot of these, I think we kind of don't know. And that's where it's a dangerous environment. And this a big problem with spending all of our money and resources on yet another war in the Middle East is that our infrastructure, whether we're talking about just the quality of the roads you drive on or like our actual cyber infrastructure and our power grid that keeps us alive and fed, all of that takes a backseat to the wars that are going on in the Middle East. I mean, just look at how much our quality of life has deteriorated in America since, you know, 9/11. People make memes all the time. You know, the world that you knew is no longer here because life, you know, was better in many ways pre 9/11. And that's not, you know, because Osama bin Laden attacked us. That's because of the wars that we launched as a result of 9/11, you know, the crackdown on our civil liberties. But like right now, this is a great. I mean, President Trump ran on a broad set of domestic policies that resonated with a lot of American people, like lowering the cost of living, a secure border, you know, cleaning up the crime, these types of things. And he hasn't been able to prioritize any of those agenda items because all of the effort is going into the war in Iran. And every now and again, you know, they sealed the border. There's no more massive invasion like there was under the Biden administration. And that's great, but it's kind of doing the minimum. But everything else, whether it's, you know, getting the illegals out of our country who are actually dangerous, like that simply has not happened in a meaningful way yet. The fact that the inflation is still out of control, the price of the pump, all of our efforts are going into this war that most American people have no idea what, you know, why we're fighting it and they don't support it. And it's the same thing with our infrastructure. I think we do have real threats here. There are real terrorist organizations that do want to harm us here in America. But instead of addressing those in a very surgical, methodical, and focused way, we're picking a new fight and we're going to create a new set of blowback terrorism. terrorism that's going to affect us here in America. Most of the terrorist acts that we had by individuals over the last year or so, they have stated in some way, shape, or form that they were inspired by what took place in Gaza and the images coming out of Gaza. I fear, and I hope that I'm wrong, but I fear we're going to see a similar wave here in America of people saying that they were inspired by, you know, what we've done in the war in Iran. And so the big question is any of this worth it? Is it worth us prioritizing the war in Iran and taking our eye off fixing our grid, securing our grid, and just really at the end of the day, taking care of our own people? And I think if you went and asked most Americans, they would say, no, absolutely not. They want our priorities here addressed and not yet another foreign war in the Middle East.
100%. Well, right. I mean, the Pulse nightclub shooting was a response to foreign bombing abroad. It was not a homophobic act. And yet that was hidden from us. So I want to ask you a little bit about Syria. I know Clayton said he was asking the last question, but I'm going to. Because now sanctions have been lifted on Syria because we've got an Al-Qaeda terrorist at the lead at the presidency who is our puppet now. So, I mean, I guess that would be a formula that Iran could follow. If you just put an American puppet in the seat, then sanctions are lifted. How does that strike you? Because that seems extremely hypocritical on our part, but c'est la vie.
Yeah, I mean, we are where we are. Like, I was really, really apprehensive about us engaging with Al-Shara Jalani, and we should still keep an eye on him. But we are where we are now. And so far, all we can do is look at the actions that he's taken. And in general, he's kind of doing the right stuff. He's caught in a tough spot because he's got the Israelis on one side and the Turks on the other, and they're at each other's throats. He's sitting on basically he's sitting on top of a bunch of different Al-Qaeda and former ISIS people who brought him to power, who want him to be much more extreme. So right now, he might not be the best guy. We may not like him, but whoever comes after him, and this should be a lesson, you know, for the people who are saying, you know, we could do better, et cetera. If he does get, you know, killed or removed in some way, shape, or form, then Syria's going to go into a chaotic situation. So I think at this point, considering the steps that he's actually taking to integrate the Kurdish forces, et cetera, we're in a decent spot with him. Now, if you take the logic that we've used with Shara and you apply it to the Iranians, there's no reason why we shouldn't be inviting the leadership of the Iranians to meet us somewhere neutral and then eventually invite them to Washington, D.C. to sign a peace agreement. There's no reason why we shouldn't be aggressively pursuing peace. I mean, Ahmed al-Shara, he killed Americans in Iraq, or at least fought against us in Iraq, and was in one of our prisons inside of Iraq. Now, the Iranians, sure, they supported a lot of the terrorists that were there, a lot of the insurgents that were there in Iraq as well. But if we can basically say, hey, we're realists, we're going to accept the world as it is, and we can make peace with Shara's past, there is no reason why we can't make peace with the Iranians' past. If you just look at the way the Iranians have conducted themselves throughout this entire war, they have been very deliberate. They have been very pragmatic. They have been very measured. And so I think that they have shown us over the last year or so, last 2 years, basically, that they're rational actors and we can make a deal with them. So I say, hey, look, if we're going to go down this road with Ahmed al-Shara and we can kind of accept that bitter pill, there's no reason why we can't aggressively pursue peace with the Iranian regime right now in an effort to de-escalate this situation so that we don't get sucked into a 20-year quagmire.
Hmm. Yeah, remarkable. It is, yeah. And to have that country not have sanctions where maybe it could pick itself back up again. Well, was one of the most peaceful countries in the world a number of years ago.
Yeah.
Not
also
anymore.
That's incredibly big of you to be able to see Syria in this way, given that your personal losses in Syria, you lost your wife in that war on terror. And now we've turned around and changed our policy. And so I just want to commend you on being able to see that rationally and what's best for everybody, because I might have a hard time with that take. So thank you for sharing.
I appreciate that. Last two trips I took as the National Counterterrorism Center director were into Syria to help get some of the ISIS prisoners, the hardened ISIS prisoners, transferred out to the Iraqi government, and then work on the Syrian Defense Force, the Kurdish integration, and just seeing all that country has been through, and to see that there are people there in that region that are actually trying to work diligently towards getting a peace. I actually think it's very, very inspirational, and I think there's a lot that we can learn from how the Syrian people and the Iraqi people and the people of that region are trying to put themselves back together, and they truly want peace too. I think that there's a lot that we can learn there, and we'd be much better off if we were following some of their examples in this conflict with Iran, because none of the people at the end of the day actually benefit from more war in the region.
As Mr. Prinzel says here, Joe Kent is a real American patriot. Joe Kent, thank you so much for joining us today. As always, we really appreciate it. Thank you for your analysis.
Thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe. All right. Coming up, we're going to talk about economic D-Day, and we're going to go a little bit more deeply into that. What does that look like in terms of sanctions? How will it reverberate around the world? Will it drive us away from the American dollar? By the way, is that the intentional move here to weaken the U.S. dollar and push us? Because that President Trump has said he wants a weak U.S. dollar. He said, I know it's not attractive, but a weak U.S. dollar can help bring manufacturing back to the United States and, you know, might not sound sexy. So is this the whole plan? We're going to talk about it a little bit later.
And then what does that look like for us living in a war economy? That's just the government's like, you can't have that. Wartime. Uh-oh. Economic priorities. Wartime. Like, yeah. This is not what we anticipated.
Well, like a permanent war.
Yeah.
Like, for the past 30 years, just
exactly.
War in Afghanistan, Iraq, you're just in a permanent war. So right. You've got to deal with it. You got to pay twice for your ground beef prices.
All right. And also, we're going to talk about the Ted Cruz podcast. I'm sure you're up on it, right? You're watching the Ted Cruz podcast religiously.
No, you're not.
Well, you probably are not. And in which case you would not know that it's a way for Israel to funnel money to Ted Cruz in violation of the rules in which our leaders are not supposed to accept foreign money. So we're going to talk about that in a second.
They really care about rules. I mean, you know,
yes.
Nancy Pelosi just bought like millions of dollars and like calls for NVIDIA and God knows what else.
Rules so, for us, yeah. Not for them.
All right. But first, I want to tell you about our friends at Century H2O. You know what's wild? We spend extra money on organic food, clean beauty products. We have air purifiers in our house. But when it comes to the water we're drinking, cooking with, and even showering with every day, most of us just assume it's fine. The truth is what's actually in your water might surprise you. Across the country, testing has found contaminants like PFAS, which are forever chemicals, chlorine, fluoride, arsenic, heavy metals, other unwanted substances in drinking water supplies. And that's why we want to tell you about Century H2O. We just installed this in our house about 6 days ago. And I'm going to tell you, we spent a lot of money years ago on getting a reverse osmosis system, only to learn that it's basically killing our water, removing all of the important minerals like magnesium and everything from our water. And so once I took that out and installed the Century H2O, I'm telling you, it's been an absolute game changer. And I feel like a dupe. I feel like a total dupe because the money that I spent years ago on it, and we're all sort of sold this idea of reverse osmosis systems and what it does. It's bunk. And when it kills your water, then you're not getting these essential minerals in your body. You're also not getting the oxygenation that Century H2O provides. It's been a game changer for me. I'm telling you, we installed it in our laundry room sink. And I've been telling the kids, like, you go there, fill up your water bottles for school. It's really fantastic. You will notice how incredible it tastes and just how much it does for your body. Like, even for me, instead of getting up like three times in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, No more because of the oxygenation in it. And it actually, it shrinks your prostate, actually. So anyway, there's so much I could talk about. I'm super excited about this. Restores clean, balanced, mineral-rich, oxygenated water in your house. It's affordable, and it's an American company. These are the same guys, by the way, that went into East Palestine, Ohio, and donated so many of these systems to get all of that the vinyl chloride out of the water to help the people in East Palestine. They also did the same thing in North Carolina. They didn't even want me to talk about this, but I'm just talking about it because, to me, they are American heroes. So anyway, check them out, and you're going to get 10% off. If you're interested in having cleaner water in your house, go to centuryh2o.com/redacted and you'll save 10% by using that code redacted. Try it. Visit centuryh2o.com/redacted to find the system that's right for you. Plus you'll save 10% with promo code redacted. centuryh2o.com/redacted and use that promo code redacted. Everyone deserves clean water in this country.
Well, Israel sponsors Ted Cruz's podcast in order to help him spread his pro-war agenda. How is this legal? Well, Responsible Statecraft found that the money is funneled through iHeartMedia directly to Cruz's super PAC. The ads are mostly around the I Am Israel campaign. It's a campaign that's meant to encourage Christians to visit the Holy Land. Of course, politicians are not supposed to take money from foreign governments, but according to Responsible Statecraft, there is a loophole in this deal because Cruz is not directly or indirectly getting the money from a foreign national, but he's hosting the podcast, who sponsors the podcast, so he can't take it directly, but through his super PAC, and then here is his podcast. Now, you'll notice here, this is his YouTube version. 1,700 is not a, what I would call a lot of subscribers.
That's videos.
Videos, yeah. So 400,000 subscribers. It's not a ton for such a high-profile person, but he does get, like, he just launched a whole series on Justice Clarence Thomas. So clearly he's trying to promote, you know, he's, why would you want his, you can tell I'm struggling because he is such a dolt. But anyway, some people do seem to, I don't know, like, here's the question. Is it a shell game that they don't even care if people listen because this is the, you know, the storefront, the cover? I don't know. So we're going to talk to the author of this report. Connor Eagles is the managing editor at Responsible Statecraft, and he broke the story. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. So what do you make of this? Do you think he actually cares about the podcast, or do you think this is like a purposeful ruse? Because I mean, do you think he really thinks people want to listen to him in a podcast? You can tell what I'm asking, what I'm implying,
right?
Because he's
right.
Odious.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting story because, believe it or not, people do listen to this podcast, as far as we can tell. So you saw, of course, that there's 500,000 subscribers on YouTube. The numbers that we've seen from Politico in one report about the podcast from 2025 said that there were as many as 2 million monthly downloads. And that is in no small part because it's been syndicated under this very unusual deal with iHeartMedia, which allows them to take money from a company, which would usually be illegal, but allows that to happen because the money goes straight to the Truth and Courage PAC, the super PAC that acts only in the interests of Ted Cruz, but is not formally directed by Ted Cruz. So it's this very interesting arrangement. I'm not sure if there's anything else like it, but now one of their big sponsors, as of course the report showed over the past few weeks at the very least, is the literal government of Israel encouraging people to come to Israel and to sort of revive tourism there. So it's a sort of remarkable story.
I mean, I guess as journalists, you always have the sponsors of your platform, but you are supposed to act independently of this. But Ted Cruz never acts independently of the Israeli government. There's no daylight between what they want and what he puts out. He said so, that his number one goal as an American politician is to support Israel. So, you know, there's no daylight here. When you look at what he does, what he says, what he promotes, right?
No, certainly not. There is a very strong, you know, as you referenced, Cruz is one of the most pro-Israel people in Congress. He has taken significant money from the pro-Israel lobby, people like Miriam Adelson, the wife of late casino magnate and pro-Israel donor Sheldon Adelson. So he's extremely tied into pro-Israel causes. He even said on Tucker Carlson's show last year that he, you know, AIPAC raises a lot of money for me, basically, right? So he's very much in lockstep with this, and this is just another way for Israel to sort of get more support towards him. But it is, again, completely legal. That was sort of the shocking part when I went through the reporting of this, because I even talked to some of the people that, or got comment from some of the people who brought the initial complaint against Cruz at the Federal Election Commission for this weird podcast arrangement deal. And they thought that it was illegal, but the FEC said, you know what, in the era of super PACs after Citizens United, you just are allowed to have these sort of arrangements that get around the meat of campaign finance laws.
I mean, he can plead ignorance, but not anymore. Like, oh, I don't know who, you know, this is a third party selling ads on the platform. But it's also a little bit distasteful that there should be ads on a politician's media channel. But I guess that's allowed too, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, so under this arrangement, as long as they set it up in this way, it is allowed. What's interesting, though, is, again, even if he somehow didn't know about this, the person doing the ad read was Ben Ferguson, who is his co-host. Right. This was not some random person. There's plenty of chance that he was in the studio. So this is he knows about this.
OK. And so I went and I looked at one of their videos for I Am Israel. And it's very much, you know, it's beautiful here. I'm free here. You know, this is an oppressed land, but we rise kind of things. If you look, there were 11 comments, all of them positive. So I'm fairly certain that they are deleting comments because this is the kind of thing that you see on X all the time that just gets hammered of like, oh, genocide tourism. There's not a single comment like this. So it is highly curated, right?
Yeah, it certainly seems to be. And the broader pitch here is very clear. They've had events around this at the launch event in June for the I Am Israel campaign. They had the Israeli ambassador to the U.S. who made the point that, you know, Israel has gone out and fought these wars for the past few years. It has gotten a lot of negative press, but it's defeated its enemies. And now it is the responsibility of this campaign to bring the people back to Israel. The difference, we got the numbers, and the monthly Americans going to Israel in 2019 was something like 100,000, and today that's down to like 20,000. So this is a really big difference, and it's a really important way for Israel to sort of do soft power influence in the U.S., especially among Christians.
Right. It's just not thought of as like a, you know, destination Hawaii right now.
No, I wouldn't say so.
Yeah.
Connor, can I jump in and ask a question here? I'm sorry to interrupt this flow, but I just can't help. I'm just on their YouTube channel, The Verdict with Ted Cruz, and have you guys dug into these numbers? It sounds like you have in part, but I'm just curious because with 460,000 subscribers and 1,700 videos, you would think that the view count on most of these videos would be way higher, significantly higher. And almost all of them have like under 1,000 views per video. You know, you're 864 views. One-on-one with Clarence Thomas, part two, 700 views. This one is probably the biggest one with 261,000 views, but almost all of them are like almost no views, 900 views, 4,000 views. Like, do you get the sense, because you can buy, you know, you can buy subscribers. People do that. You know, there people use like bot farms and other places. It just seems very fishy to me. I'm not accusing anybody. I'm just saying it just seems very fishy. These numbers seem completely out of alignment to me.
Yeah, my best guess on that, I mean, again, this is a guess. We're sort of in speculation land here, but I think that it was more popular initially and that it became less popular over time because, so he first, it was 2020 that he launches the podcast, and the idea is that it was going to be where he would defend Donald Trump during the first impeachment that year. So he would sort of use it as a political tool there. It ended up taking off and getting a lot of attention in those first couple of years. That leads to this iHeartMedia deal in 2022. And from there, I think things started to sort of flag a little bit. And if you look, too, at the individual contributions, so you can actually see each of the payments that iHeartMedia has given, at least up to the end of June of this year, to the podcast. And you can see these sort of seem to go down a little bit after spiking around 2024. So it seems as if maybe there are fewer people listening on the main feed, too.
It's like, you know, when you're really doing investigative journalism, I need to know who is loyal to Ted Cruz podcast. We got to find that person and ask them, what the hell is wrong with you? That's the main crux of this. It's like, it's so offensive that anyone would listen to his platform because I just find him so distasteful. But who do you think, like, again, speculating, who's sticking around to this smarmy asshole?
I mean, look, your guess is as good as mine. I don't think that either of us knows where this audience is coming from. Clearly, I mean, it's a dwindling percentage of the Republican electorate that is interested in this in any way. I mean, that's a big part of why not just his views on Israel, but his views on lots of other things, too, are becoming less popular. And that's a big part of sort of why they're trying to do campaigns like this, is that they're trying to make Israel more popular among Christians, perhaps the types of Christians who will listen to this podcast. I don't know if that's actually going to happen. Again, I have a bit of a hard time figuring out who's listening to this. But again, I mean, this is a guy who got reelected to the Senate 2 years ago with some number of votes. So clearly there's people that want to get his take on things. I also have a bit of trouble believing that it's 2 million downloads a month.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, we've seen the U.S. government has prosecuted Michael Flynn for less of a tie to Russia. And, you know, and yet, so I would feel like it would be dangerous if the United States were not so in lockstep with the Israeli government. Like, this is something that, in 1984 style, if we flip allegiances, you could be punished for this. But he seems free to do it. And you did reach out for comment to ask him and didn't hear anything back, right?
No, yeah, we didn't hear back. And you raise a really important point there about the fact that it is just because the U.S. and Israel have had such a close relationship that they're able to sort of continue things like that, and they don't get as much scrutiny. But as we're seeing a big shift in this relationship, I mean, I think there's a reason that people paid attention to this story in particular. People are really tired of Israeli and pro-Israel money flooding into our politics, and it's gone, you know, way, way up in recent years. There's always been a lobby in favor of Israel, but ever since Citizens United opened the floodgates of funding for elections from these big dollar donors, people like, again, I mentioned Miriam Adelson, people like Jeff Yass, these people who can donate, you know, tens or hundreds of millions in each of these cycles, you're seeing just extraordinary amounts of money from people who say that it is their primary goal with that money to advance the U.S.-Israel relationship. So, you know, they see that there is a reduction in support, and they're trying very hard to keep a lid on that.
Right. And it just pisses us off more. It just has the exact opposite effect. So thank you for joining us and sharing this reporting. Great job.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Connor. He was great.
Yeah. All right. I can see that you're really upset about a Ted Cruz YouTube channel.
Well, no, I mean, hey, fine. If someone launches a channel and it's organic and their growth is organic, sure. Good for them, you know. But I think a lot of these brands, and you certainly saw that with like this weird, like daily, like how did the Free Press, remember? I mean, they're selling for millions of dollars,
right?
And there's like no views. Like,
yeah.
And then the ones that they are getting seem like they're fake views anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. They're, you know, these. Because it's like artificial. I mean, I don't know exactly how it works, but it's like artificial, you know, in order to prop up their brand, then they try to sell their company or they try to, I don't know.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah. Maybe bots are listening.
For sure.
He's broadcasting to bots.
Yeah. I mean, and you want to destroy your channel? Like.
Yeah.
Like you won't get any organic reach at all? Like you want to. But YouTube is very sophisticated in like putting a cap on all that stuff. So I don't know.
And even I am interested in Justice Clarence Thomas, but there's no world in which I'm going to watch him talk to Ted Cruz.
No.
And so, you know, I read his book. I find him a compelling figure. But no, I don't care what he says to Ted Cruz at all.
Let's take some chats here. You want to take some chats?
Sure. From Humongous Shift, we have a representation for hire system. Nothing new. That's right. It's a pay for play. Absolutely. From Lion and the Lamb, Clayton was great on Fox back in the day. This show is even better. Love the conversations always. That's nice of you to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Back in my Fox News days.
Yeah.
Back in the mornings. All right. How many of you used to watch Fox and Friends? So I did that for about 10 years in the mornings. And it's crazy. It's a crazy world to think of.
Knights of the Storm. Rule of thumb for me is when I see an influencer with 500,000 followers and the count is like 2 months old, they are controlled. Yeah, we're learning this with the Data Republican story. You know what? You can't endear yourself to anybody online. You have to just think for yourself. Not even us. Not even. We're glad that you're here. We love you. But you need to keep an open mind about anything. We are going to really try to never disappoint you. But damn, if you're not just constantly disappointed by people online, right? So don't worship humans.
No, and I'm just curious, too. Like someone said, like the like ratio. You can always tell these like fake numbers, right?
Yeah.
David maybe can speak more to it because he studies the that side of YouTube maybe more. But like the number of likes or people commenting. Yeah, go ahead, David.
It's very easy to see. Like if you go on, the views are really high and there's a certain ratio. Like you see a video that has 1 million views, but like 400 likes and, 300 comments, that's fake. You know, and a great example is Ben Shapiro. If you go look at his videos now, it's got tons of views and his comments and likes don't correlate with those views. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's pretty obvious if you know what you're looking for.
They're interessant. Well, thank you for that. All right. Well, we've got more news to get to. We're going to talk about economic D-Day. Professor Robert Pape is going to join us here in moments. Of course, he of the escalation ladder and has been watching this escalation. Are we entering a new phase of this escalation? Maybe not in the hot war way, but in the sanctions way, and what this will mean for the economics reverberating around the world, pushing people further away from the U.S. dollar. We're going to also play you the soundbite there from Scott Bessent. And Mike Pompeo came out of the woodwork over the past few hours to also comment and chime in on how great this thing was that Bessent put out there. But first, if you've been thinking about investing in real estate, but you're not sure where to begin, or you already own property and want to build a portfolio that can actually lead to financial freedom, I want to tell you about the free weekly wealth workshops. These are hugely popular. We have so many people that watch and tune in from our team, from our viewers here, and watch the wealth workshops from Sidera Wealth every Thursday at noon Eastern. The Sidera Wealth team goes live to break down the real world strategies behind successful real estate investing. They cover everything from purchasing your first investment property to building and managing a financially free portfolio. You're going to hear practical financial tips, learn how to evaluate opportunities, and get insights from special guests, including property management professionals, experienced industry experts, and actual Sidera Wealth clients who are putting these strategies into action. We, of course, are big advocates of owning real, tangible assets in the United States in order to protect you and your family, whether it's gold, silver, real estate, real, tangible assets that have sustained for thousands of years. This isn't just theory. These workshops are designed to provide practical information to help you take your next steps with greater knowledge and confidence. The workshops happen every Thursday at noon Eastern, and registration is free. So right there on your screen, go to it if you want to check it out. SDIRAWealth.com/workshops. That's SDIRAWealth.com/workshops. Join the team this Thursday. Start building your personal roadmap for your first property and towards financial freedom. All right. So get your questions in here about economic D-Day if you'd like. Let's see here. Any other questions? Do end criminal property taxes? I wish. Redacted, maybe invite Ghost of BPH on your X show. Also on the Alpha Warrior show, he knows the Middle East for sure. Have we had on? I feel like we might have had on. Can't recall. We have a lot of great guests here on the show, like our next guest, which we'll get to here in a second. Well, it's hard not to look at what the Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent just did and think to yourself, they are intentionally weakening the U.S. dollar. After all, President Trump told us that was his goal. A weakened U.S. dollar would flood the United States with manufacturing, right? That's the plan. Instead of the petrodollar, we would have a North American U.S.-backed oil dollar, essentially. Or maybe it's backed by stable coins. Who the hell knows at this point? It would drive scores of other countries, though, into the hands of BRICS nations, clearly, and a currency that's maybe backed by gold, China, Russia, etc. This week, Bessent directed the Treasury to launch an economic D-Day against Iran. He almost sounds out of breath and almost as if he doesn't really believe what he's saying or doesn't want to even have to carry the water for the administration on this. But listen.
Today, at President Trump's direction, the United States Treasury has begun Operation Economic Outcast, an unprecedented campaign against the Islamic Republic of Iran and its enablers. In the Second World War, D-Day marked the historic beginning of a campaign with our allies to target and drive the enemy from its positions, including those in third countries. Today, in that same spirit, we are launching an economic onslaught against Iran's financial connections around the globe. Our objective is to sever every economic lifeline that sustains this tyrannical regime until Tehran stands alone. Iran's fanatics devote themselves to death to America and seek nuclear weapons to do just that. They have murdered and maimed more of our citizens and service members than any other terrorist regime on Earth.
Interesting. So will this economic D-Day work, and how will it work exactly? What's really happening to the U.S. dollar right now? Well, Robert Pape is a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago and author of The Escalation Trap on Substack. And the professor has been, of course, talking about this escalation trap and ladder that we've been seeing over the past few months. And the professor joins us now. Great to have you back on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So are we entering, well, first of all, I guess two questions. I wanted to ask both of them. That's the way my Capricorn brain works sometimes. So let me stop myself. Let me ask one question. First of all, what do you make of this economic D-Day plan from the Trump administration?
I think this is going to suck us deeper into an escalation trap, and it's the road to more military force, not an off-ramp to military force. So I say this based on 30 years of studying not just air power, but parallel to my studies of air power, I've been studying economic blockades, and I've been studying economic sanctions. And I have really focused on the period from World War I until the present. And what you see with the economic D-Day plan is it's actually quite similar to other, they didn't call them D-Days, but it's quite similar to economic D-Day plans that we've seen from World War I to the present. The British, Winston Churchill, First Lord of the Admiralty, he launched what you call an economic D-Day plan against Germany in World War I. The most stringent sanctions and blockade on Germany meant to starve German civilians in World War I, and 700,000 civilians died as a result of that blockade, mostly very young, very old due to disease and malnutrition. World War II, just to pick another case, Japan. America, we slapped heavy oil sanctions on Japan. It's an island, so you can cut off the island. We also had then a naval blockade, so the 1-2 punch you hear Scott Bessin talking about. That did not cause Japan to surrender. In fact, we now know, because we have all the documents, that the oil sanctions in July 41 were the key trigger to lead Japan to attack us on Pearl Harbor. That was the trigger. If we look at Saddam Hussein, so get more near in time. In the 1990s, we kick Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, and then we keep these draconian sanctions on Iraq, including oil sanctions and a land blockade on Iraq for 12 solid years. We drop the GDP by 50%. Some 500,000 civilians are killed during this period, I should just point out, mostly babies, the young, the very old again. And doesn't break the regime. And what we do is we have to invade Iraq with 150,000 ground forces. And then just one more, which is Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin invades Ukraine, February 2022. We slap the most extreme sanctions ever on a state. That's what it's always the most extreme, folks. What has happened? This did not cause Putin to collapse. He readjusts. And the bottom line is, they are fighting in Ukraine the most extreme war of attrition, ground war of attrition, since World War II in Europe. So I just want to point out that we have a history of what happens with these economic D-Days, and they can bite, and they will probably bite pretty hard on Iran, but that highly unlikely to cause the regime to collapse. Instead of causing it to collapse, it's likely to harden the regime. And what's the result? We're likely to end up using more force.
More force. So you answered the question I was going to ask, which is, what will this lead to? Will this lead to maybe a shift into a different type of escalation, which is more of an economic cyber attack style escalation rather than a hot war? But you believe
here's what is left out of the equation so far, and why that pattern in history repeats itself with such regularity. the pattern is not just a pattern historically, but politically. You see, what these harsh economic sanctions and blockade are going to do, including the secondary sanctions, they are going to inflict more pain on the Iranian people. And as that pain is felt by the Iranian people, they are likely going to lash back. And in fact, Iran's already in the last few weeks been attacking the UAE, some other areas rather aggressively. They've been initiating just in the last few weeks. Well, as they initiate and do more harm, which they may well now do even more harm, we will feel the pinch at home. Our gas prices will go up if Iran squeezes even more in Hormuz. And what's that going to do? It's going to make some of us more angry than we are. And that's how you end up moving people toward the war. So I think that what you look when you look at these patterns of D-Day maximum pressure, these aren't off-ramps to war. These are the Western way of war. This is how you persuade liberals. You've done everything possible. The bad guys are still hurting us. We don't want to really do it, but reluctantly, we're going to have to escalate.
Right.
That's been the pattern within history over and over and over again.
Right. No, it's a great point because people think, well, the false flag that was Pearl Harbor, we knew it was coming, right? That's, but hey, now we have this rallying. We have this flag. We can rally around Pearl Harbor and we're going to stand up to the tyranny of the
FDR,
Empire of Japan.
FDR took full advantage of Pearl Harbor. In fact, in my academic world, there is a debate among at this time, did FDR do that on purpose?
Yeah, well, I mean, I believe that's the case. I mean, when you know that this is coming and you have the opportunity to prevent it from happening, and when you get in front of Congress and you address them and you talk about the attack on Pearl Harbor, but you conveniently leave out the Philippines, you leave out all of these other islands that were also simultaneously attacked in order to rally the American public around one move, which is the attack on Hawaii. To me, clearly. But anyway, but I think you bring up a great point. The catalyst was the oil before Pearl Harbor. And so then you have what we're now seeing and how this will reverberate across the United States, you know, food crisis. I keep continuing to see and talk to ranchers and others about the coming food crisis in the United States, you know, cascading, of course, from diesel and energy constrictions, but also the lack of food that we are not growing as a result of all of this. Like, where do you see that piece of the puzzle fitting in?
What I see happening is we are being squeezed in with energy in the world's economy. And as you squeeze, it's not a knockout punch. So people keep expecting there to be this sort of knockout that could occur. And maybe the AI bubble will pop or something like that will happen. But we're already seeing the shocks that occur. In June, you saw President Trump sign an MOU saying he was worried about the world going off the edge. That's a shock. Now we're seeing Bessent reacting. And why is he reacting? Because Hormuz is shut. He's looking for a way to open it. This is a shock here. And so this is what's happening. And as the squeeze happens, what you say gets worse. And we're seeing that we're in $40 trillion. We're doing this with $40 trillion of debt. We're in an interlocked global financial system. And Scott Bessent himself on Monday, just want to repeat something he said so that everybody makes sure they hear this. So somebody asked him, why aren't you already hitting China hard now? Go get them now. And he said, well, I want to issue a warning first because I don't want to break down the whole world financial system.
He said blow it up. Yeah, I don't want to blow up the world.
He
was even harsher than the way you described it. I don't want to blow up the entire world financial system. What?
Think about this. This is our Secretary of the Treasury saying this. He's unleashing a plan where he's reluctant to actually do it because it could only blow up the entire financial system, our $40 trillion in debt, We're already paying the biggest item in the U.S. federal budget's already interest on the debt. This is already, that was before the Iran war. This is going to be much, much, much worse. And so what you are seeing here is we are playing with fire and we could burn down the entire house.
Well, I think you bring up a great point. And, you know, to me, it seems intentional. I can't help but think, Professor, that this is all part of the plan. After all, we heard President Trump on multiple occasions talking about, I like a strong dollar, but I think really having a weak U.S. dollar is how we can shift economically in the United States, do what China
did. I would say here is you are seeing plans come out of the administration, and you're also seeing deeper plans come out. I think the big thing that's left out here is the transition period to this weak dollar and how bad that could be. I think many people are imagining it must be a soft landing that's coming. If we're going to transition, we wouldn't do it in a way that would be abrupt and break things. I think rather we should just take remember the phrase from Elon Musk when he did Doge, he's going to break things and then we'll just fix them. I think this is what you're seeing in this administration. They're breaking things, and as they break them, they're trying to fix them, but the breakage is much worse than we're being, warned about up front. That's what I'm trying to do with this D-Day plan. I'm trying to point out that, yes, we have a question, will China go along? I don't think they'll go along for all the reasons a lot of other people think, but I think beyond that, the really big issue is this is the road to more escalation. This will encourage Iran to attack. I believe they already have the UAE in their gun sights. And the UAE is one of the key countries that's been getting oil out through this the Gulf of Oman. You take that out, our gas prices go up more. So it's not true Iran has done its worst. It can do much worse, and we're encouraging that. And I think this we're going to feel the punch. We will pay the price for this.
And President Trump, even a week ago on the campaign trail, said, it's okay. Americans can just, you guys will endure a little bit more in gas prices. That's how it's being sold to us. You'll just endure a little bit more in higher gas prices. But of course, the truth is much harsher than all of that. Of course, we're seeing it in our food prices. We're seeing it all across the board in the United States.
Well, I think the price hasn't. So I did an analysis on my escalation trap Substack a few weeks ago because I wanted to get inside of this a little more because people are always asking, what's the break point of Iran? What are the break points with the United States? And I think this is on the escalation trap Substack, one of the live briefings. But basically, right now, we're just at $4.10 for average annual national price of oil. If this gets up to $5.50, if this goes up a much, that next level in a serious way, even for just a few weeks, you're going to see a much different picture, a much different reaction, because suddenly that's just the price of gasoline. You see, diesel is much higher than that, and diesel is what carries all of that food. So when you talk about food here, this is the price of diesel will go up. So I believe that we're not there yet. We're sort of we've moved up. We're feeling the pain, but we're not at the level of the serious costs that could be just around the corner. And that's what I worry about. Iran is now, we're incentivizing Iran to push on the door they're already pushing on, which is to literally shut down UAE oil, literally shut down Saudi oil at the time when our SPR, their strategic petroleum reserves, are really going to run out around the time of the midterms. And we always anticipate this. We have runs on the bank before the bank actually runs out. You see, so you don't have to wait for the SPR to actually hit rock bottom. So we really are in this really precarious moment. And I think once you get the gas prices up that next rung higher, so they went from 280 to 410 in this war so far, you go that next rung up, now all of a sudden things are going to be much, much, much more costly here on Americans, and they're going to let you know it.
U.S. banking system is also facing kind of enormous stress at the same exact moment. You're seeing this in the U.S. housing market and, of course, commercial loans, and who knows what's about to happen here. All of this, I feel like this is a perfect storm, Professor. I mean, the American dollar is worth less today than it was yesterday, and that's going to be the same thing tomorrow, and our buying power is diminishing, and they want a weaker dollar, in my opinion, and I think they're pushing us into a system of whether it's some sort of a digital currency system, a U.S.-backed stablecoin system. This is all sort of meant to drive us in a certain way. I get the feeling about
it. It may be, but here's the analogy that I often use with my Substacks, which is the 2007 housing crisis, which started with the no-doc loans.
Right.
And just to recall and tell people who weren't really following things at that point in time, we had lots of warning, just like we do now. Starting in the summer of 2007, we saw these failure rates in some of they were called junk bonds. And I can remember all these shows, people, you know, very important people telling us not to worry. And then what happened in the fall in October is we had Lehman Brothers fail. It was essentially the first failure of a financial institution. Once you had that happen, it was like the dam broke. And now, all of a sudden, you were in the mega crisis that went on for 2 years. And this was when we felt President Bush and President Obama, both of them bailed out these giant financial institutions to the cost of their actual constituents. And suddenly we learned that these banks were too big to fail. So all this idea that we're going to, you know, make all these changes, what might end up happening here is the little guy ends up paying all the price. The richer you are, the better off you are in this situation. And I would just go back to the 2007 crisis here. And it was really stunning with Barack Obama, because many of his supporters, and I saw them and talked to them at the University of Chicago all the time. I mean, this was a constant thing. How could Obama do this to all of his supporters here? And it was bailing out those banks. So this is what I worry about. Who will be the layman here? Will it be Japan? Will it be, say, South Korea, maybe? Will it be the UAE? Who's going to be the first of a major institution of some kind that's literally going to fail? And that will trigger the panic, which is the run on the bank syndrome.
Well, it won't be BlackRock, because last time they called Larry Fink and they said, Larry, we need you to buy up all this stuff and save us. That's essentially what had to happen last time. Stanley Druckenmiller, who's Scott Benson's, you know, colleague, friend, good friend, and protege of George Soros, published a piece in The Wall Street Journal the other night saying, let the bond market speak, and basically saying that we have to get rid of this debt. Like, it's unsustainable. This was like a shot across the bow of Washington. Mm-hmm. Like, we cannot keep spending like this. Both Democrats and Republicans, get your head out of the toilet. We need to stop this spending. And then Scott Bess and his friend goes out there the next day and, you know, I'm sure it's like you have to wonder if he's carrying the water.
This is also back to, again, my analogy with the housing crisis in 2007. We saw the no-doc problem coming for years. We wouldn't fix it because it was politically harmful to the big donors in both parties. Right. That's what happened here. It's not we didn't see it coming. We stuck our head in the sand. Both parties, by the way. Again, that's what I'm trying to explain.
Yeah.
It was a both-party thing, and I think you're seeing something similar here. We see it coming. This tidal wave is coming, but we're deciding because the donors, the people with the money here, would be hurt if we actually stop this. I think this is one of our big problems with our country. That's also leading to political violence and disillusionment with the establishment. So I'm about to come out with this book, Our Own Worst Enemies, which is analyzing why do you have a rise of political violence in the United States. A lot of the reason is disillusionment with the economics of our country, which is shuttling so much to the uber rich. And what you see is this is not just a one-off. It's not a one-party thing. And so that's one of the reasons why you're getting massive disillusion with politics. And it's underneath some of the rise of support for political violence. Just think Luigi Mangione. So these are not independent factors. They're not just interesting to to talk about on our shows, although they are interesting, I'll grant you that. But it's much more consequential, and we're just waiting again for the first dam to break. And when that happens, I don't think it's going to be so easy. Because see, in 2007, we weren't $40 trillion in debt.
Yeah.
Now we're $40 trillion in debt. So when we go to bail out now, where are we getting that other $5 or $7 trillion? We're not.
It's a great question. And you know, people in the chat room are asking, Professor, like, what happened to that Venezuelan oil? Like, we're all, you know. And then, what do you think will be the breaking point moment? What, in your opinion, will be the Lehman Brothers moment?
The dirty secret with the Venezuelan oil is that it's going to take civilian contractors going into those jungles in Venezuela and taking the risk of being killed by the guerrillas. So this is why nobody is developing Venezuela. It's not because it doesn't have oil. It is sluggish oil. But the bottom line is it's too dangerous, and the companies just won't do it because they don't want to die. They want a paycheck.
Well, and if the price of oil keeps plummeting and goes up, I mean, it's such a huge risk for them, right, to put up these oil derricks, do all of this work and infrastructure if the price of oil is going to plummet the next day because we don't
and
know.
And the price could plummet, but also if the guerrillas just take it over. Right. So we got to understand, this is not a stable, this isn't Arizona. We're not moving into Arizona or some stable place here. We're talking about areas that actually have some real violence in them. And we've been studying that violence for decades. So the idea you're going to plunk civilian contractors into this, it's just not reasonable here. I think the real crisis here, the danger zone is going to go through January. Somebody wants to know a little more prediction here. So again, please join Escalation Trap Substack. You'll get much more of this. But January is likely going to be the time frame that Iran is going to really keep pushing the pedal to the metal. And then in January, likely to reorient and rethink. Why? Because come January, everybody, Iran included, is going to start to be in a post-Trump world. They're going to start thinking, what's beyond President Trump? And that then can open up some doors. So between now and January is our true danger zone. That's the danger zone. And this is, I can't tell you what day, so people want to polymarket everything. But right. What I'm telling you is this is our danger zone, and don't expect things to get better between now and January 3rd. Once the new Congress is seated, however, that will change the time frame for everybody. We'll all be calculating a post-Trump world.
Wow. Oh, we are in incredibly different territory now, but I love your historical perspective because history repeats itself and we can pay attention to all of these markers, these catalysts, what happens with these economic choke points that lead to further violence. So thank you for that. Thank you for enlightening all of us. I want you to read the professor's Substack, The Escalation Trap. We'll have it linked up in the show description for people as well. Professor, always great to see you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Always great discussions here. Always.
Thank you so much, Professor. Great, great stuff.
Bye-bye.
What do you guys think about that? I know, Philip, you were going to jump in there, and I think we ran out of time.
Yeah, I stopped myself because I couldn't remember the exact numbers, but I can't remember if it's millions or billions, and that's what I didn't really want to bring it up, but there's something like, I want to say 300, either 300 million or 300 billion in oil has been sold from Venezuela, and only like 19 of the same has gone back to them, and the rest of it is just nobody knows. Nobody knows who has that money. Like it just, so it's being sold, but it's not going back to Venezuela, and nobody's really sure where it's going.
It's just one big money laundering operation, of course, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And our strategic petroleum reserves are completely depleted. And to his point, when he called it sluggish oil, it's not easy to process. It's not like the best oil in the world. It's actually some of the worst. So the risk of being off the coast of Venezuela, whether you're, and China had a big presence there and was actually helping to refine this oil until they were unceremoniously pushed out. So now does BP want to actually spend the money to do that? And at what risk to the civilians that would be on those, to his point? So yeah, But you know, this is all part of the plan, this idea of the North American, you know, technate, so that the United States, North America, it's one big monolith in North America, and we can bring the U.S., we can bring the petrodollar from Saudi Arabia into the North American petrodollar. That's why President Trump calling it the Gulf of America instead of the Gulf of Mexico. Like, all of these pieces, like, are playing out. And of course, if you listen to, like, Glenn Beck and others, like, Glenn's like, this is all part of the 5D chess that Trump has been playing. Okay. All right. So people,
I'd rather they just play 3D chess and play it well.
Spock. Yeah. Do you guys think, I mean, when I'll ask you guys in the chat room, like, when do you think it's getting better? Do you think it's getting worse? Do you think we're heading towards this giant iceberg that basically Professor Pape is talking about here in the next coming months? I mean, when you have Stanley Druckenmiller publishing that piece, maybe we can put it back up on the screen. It's worth a read. Again, friend of Scott Bessent, but he's going and he knows who's reading this when he publishes a piece like this. He knows that his friend is going to read this, and he knows that Washington, D.C. is going to read this. And here he is telling everyone, this is unsustainable. Like, we are heading for a massive disaster. So you guys want to do anything about it? I don't know. I don't think the AI bubble has anything to do with it. Maybe it'll be a small catalyst. Who knows? And even if there is an AI bubble, I don't know. Because the demand right now is still off the charts. I mean, look what NVIDIA's earnings just posted a few minutes ago. Like, double on their earnings. Double revenue. So someone's buying it. I don't exactly know. But anyway, hey, we cover all these things in our daily newsletter. It's totally free. Why don't you come over? It's redacted.inc is the place to go. Sign up for free. Just go there. It's not .com. It's .inc. Click on the top where it says newsletter. Just click on that, and then you will put in your email address, and we never sell your email or anything like that, and you will receive a welcome email. It might go to your spam folder. You just need to go to that email in your inbox somewhere, spam folder, junk folder, and click on the link and say, yes, I do want to receive the newsletter. We publish it Monday through Friday. Try to cover like four or five of the big stories of the day so that you can be more informed over your cup of coffee first thing in the morning. We have readers in Australia that tell us they read it at nighttime because it's nighttime there when they get the newsletter. Anyway, redacted.inc is the place to go. Sign up and be a part of our community here. So thanks to the thousands of you who watch us on a regular basis. I really, really appreciate it. And, you know, if you'd be so kind, I don't know if you guys are subscribed to the channel or not. Please hit that subscribe button or follow button if you're on YouTube or Rumble. Obviously YouTube loves to hide us as much as possible. And with their whole new algorithm change that they did back in this new AI algorithm change that they did back in, was it February, where now they group channels together in like little clusters. And so when you go to your home screen, you're like, how come I never see the stuff that I'm subscribed to anymore? It's because YouTube changed everything. I don't know if they're going to make it better. David, do you have any ideas if they're going to fix this thing or not? I do know that they're changing things in January, but oh my God, it's been a disaster. It's really been a disaster.
Yeah, I just think that they just released Gemini on the platform and it's just created chaos, and they're just trying to, I mean, we deal with a channel this size. We're supposed to have a person to talk to, but you never get a human to talk to. Like, they'll do reviews of our videos that they take down or whatever, which we haven't had in a while, and it's like 2 minutes for an hour long video. So it's like everything is so AI. And I think it's just like, you know, I don't think it's the platform is stable right now. So hopefully that's what they're fixing. They're going to go in there and maybe have their own AI go in and fix the AI problems.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But it's been a disaster because like, now I don't get any of the variety on my home feed anymore. Like, when I would go to the homepage on YouTube to see the channels that I'm subscribed to, and if I wanted to, I felt like watching, I don't know, this video over here, maybe a gaming video over here, maybe a fly fishing video over here. I don't see any of it. I just see like a very narrow little sampling. It's garbage. And so many people complain to us, like, we don't see your stuff anymore. Well, there you go.
Well, yeah, for me, I don't know if you get the same thing, but it's like the whole first row is stuff that I don't really want to watch. And then the second row is just a repeat of that row. It's like,
right. And well, then they're pushing crap on you too. All the short stuff, which is annoying.
I get like one, it'll usually be like one video from a channel I'm subscribed to. And then there'll be, usually if it's a channel I'm subscribed to, it's not showing me their most recent thing. It's showing me something from like 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Or stuff that I've already watched. And that's what it is. So it's like, I just keep refreshing it. So it's like, there's a lot of channels that if I want to watch their stuff, I have to go to that channel because it just will not show it to me.
It's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And it's the same thing's happening to a lot of big channels right now, but, and the way, whatever this like little AI dance that they're doing right now, but you know, Rumble, hey, we've been doing really, really well on Rumble. Our audience continues to grow over on Rumble in a big, big way. So thanks to, I see so many of the people in the comments, they're like, we're on Rumble anyway. We don't care about YouTube. So anyway, thanks to all of our folks on Rumble. We really appreciate it. And thanks to everyone watching on X as well. We have a pretty big audience on X now as well. So thanks to all of you for subscribing and being a part of us, part of our community here. And obviously everyone's traveling right now. It's the dog days of summer. So we're ramping up, you know, a lot of really interesting content, our redacted files content and things like that that'll be coming out here after Labor Day and into the fall. So hopefully we'll have a good time in the fall, I think. Anyway, a lot of great interviews lined up. So thank you guys for joining us today on the show. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for sharing us with your loved ones. And we'll see you back here tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Have a great night, everyone.